Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Begin the discussion of the possibilities of this leading to World War III, the Bhutto assassination, what it means for us, what I think we must do, how it has changed the very nature of the election itself, who has fundamentally fallen off the scale of leadership, who possibly could now emerge as a strong leader. There's no question in my mind this has deeply affected the primaries and will affect the presidential election as it should have. I'm not saying it's a blessing in disguise, don't get me wrong. However, I think we pretty much have seen who is not qualified for this office, particularly in these times. We see that the biggest political idiot is Ron Paul, who says that we should just leave the country alone to sort it out itself. Stupid, textbook libertarian idiocy. I have nothing against libertarianism. However, in a situation such as this, it's not two children having a fight in a schoolyard and say, let him fight it out. You know, one nuke could really destroy your day, and really you want global warming. Why don't you try 12,000 degrees over Denver? Because that's what you're liable to get. Speaking of Denver, Denver broke its record for the highest snowfall on Christmas Day. Everyone knows that except Al Gore and his minions of useful idiots. But we won't go into the global warming fantasy because it's quickly devolving. We will talk instead about the audience here for a moment. Again, I want to reiterate thank you to the over 7,000 of you who have sent a donation to the Michael Savage Defense Fund. And I want to, again, steer you to the MichaelSavage.com website where I gave you a special Christmas present, those of you who donated money, as well as those of you who did not donate money. My excellent attorney, Daniel, worked over the holidays for almost a week. He amended our lawsuit against the terrorist front group that is trying to drive me off the radio, and he added some very important information as to the conspiracy that this organization is allegedly involved in. And he has shown that I, Michael Savage, am only one of several Americans targeted by this group, and that I will not be the last unless these extremists are brought to justice right here in America. They are, by any means necessary, trying to convert this nation into a radical Islamic nation, according to my attorney and according to my own analysis. They tried to intimidate me. They tried to intimidate the passengers on the U.S. Airways Flight 300 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on November 20th, 2006, with egregious lawsuits. They receive overseas money, which is a violation of their nonprofit status. And by the way, as a side note, there is also another group in this country that will be dragged into this and uncovered for what they are. It will bring Hillary Clinton's campaign to the ground. Once the connections are seen between Media Matters and Hillary Clinton and the Stalinist techniques of Media Matters and the foreign money that is poured into Media Matters, you will see two things happen. You will see Hillary Clinton disconnect from this vile group called Media Matters. You will possibly see an indictment of the principles of Media Matters. Now, I didn't mean to get into this, but we pulled the tax records of Media Matters. As you well know, Media Matters is run by a crazy man who used to be a so-called conservative, discovered he was a homosexual. After he discovered he was homosexual or concurrent with it, he discovered he was a liberal. He created a group targeting conservatives in the media, including myself and others. Now, what they do is a form of a Soviet-style methodology is used by the ex-Soviet Union is what they're using. Hillary Clinton proudly said she helped create Media Matters. I would suggest that if you are a campaign manager for Hillary Clinton or you work somewhere high up in the food chain, you heartily recommend that Hillary Clinton disconnect from Media Matters rapidly, because what's about to come out in the courts may be of great embarrassment to her. And it will show that she is not as clever as she alleges to be. But let's go back to Media Matters. Are you aware of the fact that the head of it, the head honcho, David Brock, who poses as a man doing this simply to unmask conservatism and its mistakes in this country, earns over $240,000 a year in salary? Did you know that? All of you good progressives out there who hate the rich, how come you're so tolerant of David Brock's $240,000 salary as of the year 2005? We do not know what it is as of the years 2006 and 7. There are others who will be exposed when we publish their IRS form on michaelsavage.com later on next week. And you judge for yourself whether this so-called progressive group, Media Matters, is really a friend of the truth or a self-serving organ of the Democrat National Committee. But let's get back to the bigger picture. This is all going to come in the next few weeks. We're going to show you with court records, tax records, investigations done by others, who these groups really are, and the connections between radical groups in this country, radical Islamic groups, and radical political groups in this country. Unless we stand up to these radical groups in this country, we will devolve into a mess of the type you see in some of the Islamo-fascist nations themselves. That's the whole point. It's not only about me, it's about you. And that's why I'm fighting them. And that's why I'm going to continue to fight them. And that's why all of the 7,000 or so of you who've sent a donation understand this and why I'm fighting for you as well in freedom of speech. These are not simply empty words for applause. Everything is at stake. Everything is at stake. And when you wake up on a day like today and you see that Bhutto is assassinated in Pakistan, and you have morons, both Republicans and Democrats, calling for democracy in Pakistan, you realize how facile they are, how empty they are, that they truly are nothing but puppets or parrots. They're empty suits. They're very much like David Letterman and Leno, who could not speak or do a show for several weeks now because somebody did not write a script for them. They had to stay home, unshaven, and play with their motor cars. It's the same with the political dunces. Unless somebody writes a speech for them, they don't know what they're talking about. Yet they have their hands on the nuclear apparatus of this country. These schmucks don't know anything. Do you understand the danger we're in? How many different ways do I have to tell you? They're morons. They're no different than the entertainers on television. But it's no longer a laughing matter, is it? Things are spinning out of control in this world, and there are very few people on the horizon who can save this nation from a disaster. That's if we're not already over the edge of the disaster. Of the speeches I have heard today that were generated after the assassination of Bhutto, only one man stood out from all of the rest, and that was Mitt Romney. And he made a statement today that I thought showed he understood, he grasped completely what happened and what must be done. Listen to clip 4.
This points out again the extraordinary reality of global violent radical jihadism, and this type of loss of life points out again the need for our nation and other civilized nations of the West and of the Muslim world to come together to support moderate Islamic leaders, moderate Islamic people, to help them in their effort to reject the violent and the extreme.
The biggest loser today is Hillary Clinton, who has tried to show that Iraq is behind us, there is no war on terror, that if she becomes president, she would negotiate with terrorists. She was completely out of her league. Listen to clip 7.
I hope that if there is any opportunity for the government and people of Pakistan to respond to this tragedy appropriately, it would be to move more steadfastly and determinedly toward democracy.
That means nothing. Empty skirt. Period. End of story. Empty skirt. End of story. She's finished. Phyllis, Sacramento, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hi, Michael. I share your rage. I appreciate you so much coming back from vacation to share these clips with us so that we can compare and contrast the candidates. You are the truth teller. You're my soulmate in rage. And I support you 100%. I love you, Michael.
Well, thank you for being there for me. Now, I want you to understand that the folks who were filling in for me, I thought were doing a very good job. And the best ofs I thought were good, and that would have been fine. But this is a very important situation right now. Pakistan could quickly spin out of control. The nuclear weapons could fall into the hands of the extremist elements within the military who know how to use them, Phyllis. Let's not forget that when we say nuclear weapons, we mean nuclear weapons. And when we say nuclear weapons in the hands of terrorists, it doesn't mean they're a bunch of madmen who don't know how to fire them. That's what we're talking about here. That's the important thing to remember. This is no longer an intellectual discussion where you can get a Hillary Clinton getting up there giving you the double crap, the double talk. Move steadfastly towards democracy. What does that mean? It means nothing. She's full of hot air. She, like her husband, is what is known since the time of Aristotle as a sophist. You have to look up what sophistry is and what a sophist is. Hillary Clinton is the classic sophist, from which the word sophisticate is derived. But don't confuse the two.
Savage.
I'm going to read you a series of words. Specious, captious, casuistic, oversubtle, no. Abstruse, maybe. Fallacious, yes. Misleading, yes. Paralogical, yes. Unsound, yes. Invalid, illogical, deceptive, illusory, elusive, plausible, evasive, false, groundless, hollow, unscientific, untenable, fallible, unproved, inconsequential, irrational, incongruous, unreasonable, self-contradictory, inconsistent, unconnected, irrelevant, inapplicable, unwarranted, gratuitous. I think those words fairly well describe what we just heard from Hillary Clinton, but she's not alone, unfortunately. She's not alone in it. Obama was in the same category. Ron Paul showed himself to be totally off the wall, saying that we should leave them to sort it out themselves, drop our support for Musharraf. The guy is absolutely out of touch with reality. So we knew Ron Paul was just a jester, much as is Kucinich. They're the jesters of both parties. And I guess jesters have a useful role. But in a time like this, we don't have time for jesters. We need kings, not jesters. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number. Let us go around the country for your commentary. San Antonio, Texas. Donald, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Michael, let me steadfastly get to my question. Do you think this could be the event, even though all the people there are corrupt, that could pull the moderate Muslim factions together in Pakistan, and they'll go after the radicals themselves? And, of course, we should be supporting Musharraf, but do you think this could be the event that will cause that to happen?
Well, you're talking about the middle class of Pakistan, of course, the doctors, the lawyers, the accountants, the teachers, the civil servants, who are no friends of radical Islam, obviously, because they would be treated very much the way the middle class was treated by in Cambodia, where they would probably all be killed or dismissed from their jobs at the very least. Can they be organized? And if so, who would be the head of that particular faction of Pakistan is a question for someone who's more knowledgeable than I am, Donald. I don't know the ins and outs of politics in Pakistan. I can't answer it. I do know that there is a need for more power right now and a firmer assertion of American power rather than reaching out and trying to understand the radicals. And unless we encourage our leaders to actually lead, we the people are going to be in worse shape than we are today. Las Vegas, Nevada, Abdul, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. First of all, I support the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and freedom in this beautiful country of the United States of America that we live in. Hopefully,
God bless
everybody
you.
Support that. Second,
good for you.
What's going on in Pakistan is, right now, the leaders of Pakistan, from General Zia, General Musharraf, Bhutto, and the rest of them, they are tasting their own poison that they prepared for Afghanistan during the war, and they were trying to take over their country by sending Taliban, supporting the Al-Qaeda, supporting the extremists.
You're making very good sense, Abdul, but most people don't know as much as you do, so I want to go a little slower. Very few people know that when Bhutto was prime minister, she was very actively pro-Taliban. And that was because she wanted Pakistan to gain more control over Afghanistan. That is correct. Is that you agree with that, don't you?
Yeah, 100%. Actually, they wanted to take over Afghanistan indirectly by sending Taliban and puppets and torturing those people and taking over the country. And actually, they did it for six and a half years. But right now, the karma and the God, which we all believe in, is getting into them, and they're paying for their actions. So
so what you're saying is that in American vernacular, the chickens are coming home to roost, that all of the leadership of Pakistan, whether it was Musharraf or Bhutto or the opposition leader waiting in the wings right now, they're all fundamentally part of a ruling corrupt oligarchy.
Exactly.
But you're not arguing that the Taliban, excuse me, that the Al-Qaeda should take over Pakistan, are you?
Well, the Al-Qaeda and Taliban, I hope they don't, but the way everything goes, Pakistan is in a deep, deep trouble by supporting those so-called fundamentalists, which I didn't call them Muslims. I'm a Muslim. They are 100% doing everything against Islam, and
Well, I would say to you, alaikum salam, I hope that you understand that I'm a friend of Muslims, despite what the enemies of the truth want to say. I have supported the five principal religions of the earth from the day I began in radio. And I understand, by the way, that the moderate Muslim is more threatened by the radical Muslim than I am and most Americans are. And I thank you for your listenership. You know, people are trying to silence Michael Savage. That's me. I need your help. It's a big battle, a legal battle. The opposition has unlimited funds. I don't. Will you please go to michaelsavage.com, contribute $5, $10, $1,000, $10,000, or you can send checks to the trust account of Daniel Horowitz. He's my attorney. P.O. Box 1547, Lafayette, California, 94549. Daniel Horowitz, attorney, P.O. Box 1547, Lafayette, California, 94549. Say it's for Michael Savage. Thank you for helping protect freedom of speech. Go to www.michaelsavage.com, and God bless you for helping protect freedom of speech.
Hi, this is...
You know, there's a tragedy, and then there's life. Life goes on. Pat Buchanan, welcome to the Savage Nation. I'm sure you were shocked this morning, as we all were. How do you, as an isolationist, you are fundamentally an isolationist, Pat. What would you do if you were advising the president today?
Well, I'm less an isolationist than I'm an anti-interventionist. I don't think we ought to intervene unless U.S. vital interests are concerned or involved, and I don't think we should spend American lives unless our vital interests are concerned. I think what I would do today is, first, I think you've got to stand by Musharraf. He is the only power over there that's in power right now. He controls those nuclear weapons through the army. And the central concern should be U.S. vital national interests. They are to see to it that those nuclear weapons are controlled and kept out of the hands of radicals. Secondly, we do not want Pakistan breaking up or chaos there. And Musharraf, for better or worse, is the elected president now. Third, while we support the democratic elections, I wouldn't push those too hard for the reason that Mrs. Bhutto is dead. She was the most popular figure. Sharif is not running, or he's pulled out of the elections. And so what I would do is sit down and talk Turkey with Musharraf. I would send over my toughest guy, and I would say, sit down with him. Tell him, look, they tried to kill him twice at his, you know, Fort Benning, frankly. They killed her after attempting to kill her. These devils are over there in Waziristan, and we got to get serious. You're going to have to go all out and go after them, and we will help, and we will be there. But you got to realize that you're next on the list, and it is time to get...
Well, no, in other words, what you're saying is we've got to back up Musharraf with a military adventure into the hill, into the mountains, where Osama and his minions are hiding, and wipe them out. Yet we haven't heard that from any... But, Pat, we haven't heard that from any of the candidates or politicians today. All we heard were homilies about democracy. It's ludicrous to hear this rhetoric, isn't it?
Well, this is ideological nonsense. We deal with the real world. What I would tell Musharraf, clearly, there's real hostility to the United States and Pakistan because they feel we jilted them after they helped us in the first Afghan war against the Russians. We turned to India. We dumped them. India blew off nuclear weapons. They blew them off, and we wouldn't send them the fighter aircraft we owed them. I would tell Musharraf this. Look, we know your problems of having any Americans come into the country, but if we got intelligence, and we know they're there, and we can move more quickly than you, we would like to you to have deniability, you to say we didn't go in there, we have no authorization, but we want to go in and do it if we have to, and we can kill this guy or kill Zawahiri. And we want to be able to do that, but you got to do it on the QT because they're proud people. And just like we wouldn't want folks coming into our country looking for assassins here, they're not going to like it, but I would work with him. Because look,
yeah, but Pat, you were around during Vietnam. You were sitting in the center of power during that time. Even a small military venture into Laos, look what it did with regard to the left wing in this country. We've got left wing fools in this country saying that we should promote democracy. They don't even understand the realities of Pakistan. Today, Ron Paul had the nerve to say that we should drop our support for Musharraf because he's a dictator. What are they thinking, Pat?
This is insane. Look, for heaven's sakes, the United States was allied with countless dictators in the Cold War, and people like Ronald Reagan would say, is he on our side in the big war? And if Pinochet, Marcos, the South Korean generals, anyone who was supporting the United States in the war, you cut them some slack because that was a great cause upon which our survival depended. We would all prefer to have, you know, Democrats who are pro-American and pro-Western. That's not the choice we're offered in this world. And Musharraf is right now, he is the best bet. He is the only bet. You know, I was on the other dump you, Musharraf. I said, who are you going to replace this man with? And they have no idea. We'll replace
him. No. The liberals are absolutely empty when it comes to understanding the realities that they live in, whether it be the homeless bums in the street who they created or the radical Islamists who Jimmy Carter created. The fact of the matter is there's only one solution here, and that is a tough solution, Pat. But how come your advice, which was so crystal clear just now, which makes sense to me, makes sense to millions of people around the world, was not heard from today with George Bush? He said nothing as well. Bush said nothing, Pat. Never mind Ron Paul. Bush may as well have been Ron Paul's running mate.
Well, he's the president of the United States, and he should have said more. He should have laid it out for the American people. Because, listen, Michael, most Americans understand you're dealing with a country of 170 million, incredibly volatile, all manner of ethnic and differences and disagreements, religious discord, and left and right in there. And you're dealing with something like that. You've got to deal with the gravity of the situation. And the president should have, and he should have said, you know, President Musharraf is a friend of this country. He's gone on the line for us. Quite frankly, sometimes he's backed away. Sometimes he's been tough. But he's the only fellow we got there right now.
Pat, isn't it logical to you, when I said earlier, many people saying immediately, well, Musharraf did it because she was his enemy. That's nonsense, because no matter how I analyze this, can anybody come up with a benefit to Musharraf by her death? There's no. How does he benefit by her assassination?
He doesn't. They're rioting and they're blaming him, and Sharif is blaming him, saying he ought to resign. And he had worked with Mrs. Bhutto. We'd cut a deal between him and Mrs. Bhutto. He would run for president, give up his army post, turn it over to a pro-American. He would get 4 more years, whatever it is, in Pakistan for president. She would come in, win the election, be prime minister, and they would work together, and they would go after al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And it was a set deal. And then the Supreme Court came in and said, we think Mr. Musharraf's election is fishy. Because he is not qualified for it because of the Constitution, various things. So he fired the Supreme Court. She stuck with him. And then so he became enormously unpopular. The deal became unpopular, a corrupt bargain. which you call him, Sharif came rolling back and said, you know, I'm the populist figure. I'm against these two corrupt dealers. And so she backed away from Musharraf. All these things are going on. Look, this is the game that's going on. And we have to look out as we look at it. Keep your American national vital interests in mind in what is going on there. Not whether we like dictators or dislike. Everybody knows that. But keep
She herself was a populist, an autocratic opportunist of her own. She was corrupt. The family was corrupt. Her playboy husband and her sequestered tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions, into Dubai when she was thrown out of Pakistan. And yet the American leftist media portrays Bhutto, God rest her soul, as some saint who was coming back to save Pakistan, which is more nonsense. It's Disney. It's right out of the Disney tunes. So at the end of the day, we have a corrupt nation loaded to the gills with nuclear weapons. And we have no leadership in this country telling us, like you just did, what needs to be done. But to me, it's a military problem here right now, not a political problem. So having said that, do we have the military capacity to aid Pakistan in a military venture against Osama bin Laden?
Oh, sure, we got the ability. What we do not have is the ability to control Pakistan. You got an army of 500,000 men and women. And you got a Marine Corps about 175,000. That is very small. We got commitments to fight for 60 countries around the world. We got two wars going on. Afghanistan is looking very problematic right now. And what we do have, however, is the ability of special forces to go in and strike and kill and get out. We are better than that at that than anybody in the world. And that's what we ought to deal with Musharraf on and tell him, look, we understand your problems with your sovereignty and all the rest. But if we see this guy, we want to be able to strike him with these drones, predators, or we want to be able to send our guys in and strike him and kill him because he's your enemy as well as ours. And the sooner we eradicate him, the better. The problem here, Michael, is the Taliban are becoming increasingly successful in southern Afghanistan.
Well, let's pause right there. The Taliban were originally supported by none other than Ms. Bhutto. You know that as well as I. She was the one who was a very active pro-Talibanist because she wanted to extend Pakistani control over Afghanistan. So in many ways, they are her child.
Certainly the child of the Pakistan intelligence services, because the Pakistanis, because they fear India most and they detest India most, they want a strategic base camp in Afghanistan. They had it with the Taliban. They were working with the Taliban. They were their guys, and the United States was working to a degree with the Taliban. We're going to put some pipeline across there. However, when the 9/11 occurred, Bush sent his boy over there, Armitage, over there to tell him, look, now you got to choose. It's us or the Taliban, because the Taliban won't give up these killers, and we're going to take them down. And Musharraf said, I'm going with the Americans. So he cut his ties to the Taliban, but that didn't cut the ties of the military and the intelligence services, especially a lot of these young guys who are really Islamist. They are very, very militant Islamists in the army and in the intelligence services. These are the guys that tried to kill Musharraf himself. His problem is he realizes, look, they tried to kill him twice. His army's out there fighting the Taliban, and many of them are getting killed. And you got the Pashtuns in Afghanistan in great number, and they're very, very friendly with the Taliban because the Taliban come out of that tribe. So all of these problems, but the point is we have to deal with it seriously instead of talking, you know, go and get your fourth grade civics book and say we ought to have democratic elections.
Yeah, unbelievable that we would hear Hillary Clinton and the others and Bush saying we need democracy, road to democracy. It's shocking to think that such emptiness can pass for rhetoric today. But what's interesting to me as well in this horrible murder today is that the murder occurred, Pat, in Rawalpindi, which happens to be the garrison where the Pakistani military elite resides. How did that happen if they were not involved themselves, do you think?
I don't know right now. The people said the security services were involved. Her security was. However, her security was blown up as well. So I don't know exactly who did this, but clearly we ought to find out, but that's a very valid point. As I said, the two assassination attempts on Musharraf took place when he was traveling through what is sort of the Fort Benning of Pakistan, where these
right.
young radicals in the
right.
military...
Right, it says Rawalpindi is where she was killed. That is the most secure military city in all of Pakistan. It would be as though someone got killed in West Point during a motorcade. But you know, there's, I watched CNN today, and they were all... They had some guy on who was crying, who wrote a book with her that's coming out, and he was half promoting the book that's coming out and half crying for her. And they're all screaming, including some of the Democrats, that she wasn't given the protection that she had asked for, you know, scanners and this glass in the car that you couldn't see through. She popped her head out of the sunroof of the limo she was driving in just before the suicide bomber detonated the bomb, Pat. She herself exposed herself to them.
Yep. Well, look, I don't know the details of how this happened, but clearly, I mean, people talk about, when they say an inside job, I don't know who did this thing, but I sure would take a look at it. But the possibility that it could be rogue military, rogue intelligence, or people like that is certainly there. I mean, this whole place is extraordinarily volatile. And frankly, Michael, the hostility to the United States and Pakistan is as pandemic as in almost any nation on Earth. And it's because of the perception that we abandoned them and they were over there fighting Islamic radicals or were fighting Islam and all the rest of it. So, I mean, this situation is...
No, it's terrible, Pat. And, you know, at the beginning of the show, I compared the Bhutto assassination to the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand of Austria triggering World War I. We know the parallels are not direct, but certainly they're interesting to those who've studied even a modicum of history. You know, World War I occurred sort of by accident. An assassination leading to an action leading to reaction, leading to another action, leading to another reaction. We have a chain reaction called World War I, but there were no nuclear weapons, of course, in World War I. This is much more terrifying when you think about it. Would these young Turks in Pakistan, should they, let's say, wrest control of that nation, do you think they would use those nuclear weapons, Pat?
The Pakistani, if they took control of the country?
Yeah, let's take the worst-case scenario. The young Turks and the Pakistani intelligence, they knock out Musharraf, they take power, they have their finger on the nuclear buttons. What do they do next?
What I'd do is I'd talk to that top military guy and I'd say, go. Take them out any way you have to take them out. Use your army. Do what you have to do to take them out. You do not let radicals or revolutionaries get control of nuclear weapons, especially those that hate the United States and despise us. Quite frankly, the Indians would be as apprehensive of that as we are.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you. And again, that connects up to the World War I analogy. They're probably more terrified of that possibility than we should be. Then you've got the other players in the region. Let's not forget China. Let's not forget Iran. What about our good friend, the Hitler of our time, Ahmadinejad? What is he doing right now? And what did he possibly have to do with this assassination, if anything? Would he have been a friend of Bhutto or an enemy of Bhutto? Certainly an extremist like Ahmadinejad would not like a moderate like Bhutto. No matter how corrupt she was still a moderate who never would have fired a nuclear weapon at India or America. So did he have a hand in this? So there's many, many questions that need to be answered, Pat. And I appreciate you coming on the Savage Nation. I think the most interesting comment that you made, from my point of view, was the absolute disconnect from reality that liberals have when it comes to realpolitik. That's certainly something we wouldn't say about Pat Buchanan and Michael Savage, is it?
It is not. It is not, Michael.
Pat, what's your new book and when is it coming out?
Day of Reckoning. It's out. It made the New York Times list, I'm proud to say, and it's still fighting to get back on there, and it's doing very, very well. It's the Day of Reckoning, the series of crises that are coming down the road at the United States of America. It's a perfect storm, frankly, and one of them is the fact that we are, in many ways, overextended abroad. We don't have the military to do the vital necessities it has to do because we got too many commitments around the world, and of course, it deals with the border crisis, the failure to assimilate folks who have come here, the falling dollar, the trade deficits that are running at 6% of your gross national product. All of these crises are coming down the road in the first term of the next president, and I think they're going to hit all at once.
Well, it's an interesting title, Day of Reckoning, and let's pray that today is not that day of reckoning. Pat Buchanan, thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us on the Savage Nation. I'll be right back. Savage.
Is any opportunity for the government and people of Pakistan to respond to this tragedy appropriately, it would be to move more steadfastly and determinedly toward democracy.
Rubbish, empty skirt, finished, finito, end of story. You're starting to see the veneer coming off the house of Clinton. You're starting to see the plaster come off the others, and you're seeing what's underneath it all. And we really have very few choices here. This event, this bombshell of an event, the assassination of Ms. Bhutto today, has changed not only the primaries, which are irrelevant, by the way, but the election itself. Hillary was building her campaign based upon we don't need security, we don't need military, you know, it's over, Iraq is not an issue, it's the economy, Medicare, Medicaid, the environment, and that other soft stuff that the Democrats specialize in. Today, it has all changed. Suddenly, it's 9/11 all over again. It may not be 9/11 here in America, but it's 9/11 in Pakistan. And those of us with a brain understand that in this world that we live in today, a nuclear weapon in the hands of an Islamist in Pakistan is just as dangerous as a dirty bomb in the hands of a terrorist here in the United States of America. We need a tough man to save America. We need a tough, plain-speaking man to take the reins of this great nation out of the hands of the internationalists. The corruption and the greed has got to go, or we're all going to go up in smoke, and we all know that. And I'm going to tell you again, that I came back from vacation because I knew the monumental importance of the Bhutto assassination, not only to myself, but to you, the listener. I knew that you needed a place to vent. I listened to other shows, and, you know, it was very hard to find anyone really comprehending what was really going on and what was at stake. We heard the same rubbish. You know, let democracy reign. They don't know what they're talking about. To the 8,000 listeners who have donated to the Michael Savage Defense Fund on michaelsavage.com, I say God bless you and thank you.
Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Thank you for joining us. It is Peter Weisbach in for Michael Savage, who's back on vacation for the time being. Thank you for joining us. It is an honor and a privilege for me to be here. And I want to just take up from the last hour where Michael Savage, I thought, talked extremely eloquently, as he normally does on issues, but about this Bhutto assassination in Pakistan and the present situation in Pakistan. And I got to tell you a couple of things. One is, since 9/11, I mean, I have really gone 180 degrees from where I was previous to that. Previous to that situation, I was more along the lines of Ron Paul, basically pull all our troops back, stop getting involved in other countries. You know, have a strong defense, stand for freedoms, but, you know, let everybody kind of muck along and do their own thing. And if you can at all support other countries, support only those countries that have similar views and turn democratic values and principles that we adhere to in our country. And since 9/11, I must tell you, watching this, and initially, of course, I was all for the Iraq expedition, primarily because I thought, you know, the idea of planting democracy in that part of the world is a grand idea, and that hopefully if you make it a success in Iraq, by osmosis, it'll spread to Saudi Arabia, to Syria, and so forth in that part of the world. And we know that democratic nations tend not to be aggressive towards one another. Now, they'll react when they're attacked, but they won't be aggressive. They're not imperialistic. But that was before I really had a clear understanding in terms of this culture that we were dealing with, and this Islamic fundamentalist culture that has its roots primarily in Saudi Arabia, behind the Wahhabi sect of Islam, and which is being exported by the petrodollars out of Saudi Arabia around the world, including mosques in this country, our own country, paid for by, in many cases, by our own petrodollars that we send over there. It has just, and as I've become more attuned to and aware of and an understanding of that particular culture and those religious beliefs, I begin to see, you know, that this is just madness. And you take a look at Pakistan and what has happened there. Here is a woman, Harvard educated, pro-Western, a Muslim, but a modern Muslim, a modernized Muslim, a woman in that particular culture, having had leadership, seeking leadership once again. And Al-Qaeda said clearly, at least the head of Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, that they wanted to assassinate her because they saw her as America's puppet, the Western's puppet, the puppet of the West. And of course, they were successful. And I'm watching some of our presidential candidates, both political parties, Huckabee, make a fool of himself about this situation. And I think that the former First Lady, Hillary Clinton, also made an absolute fool of herself. Just run that clip about what she suggests Pakistan should do now in light of this assassination.
I hope that if there is any opportunity for the government and people of Pakistan to respond to this tragedy appropriately, it would be to move more steadfastly and determinedly toward democracy.
All right, so what would that possibly bring, that democracy, if it were at all possible to pull off in that part of the world, in that culture? I was reading an interview by Arnaud de Borsgrave, who's had contacts in that part of the world for years and years and years. He's an esteemed columnist, and he writes and he talks about the fact that, you know, that 48% of the country approves of Al-Qaeda. This is according to various public opinion polls. 48% of the country approves of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, and the Taliban. And so Savage makes the point, is, are these people ready for democracy? Or do we find ourselves in the cause of the greater war having to support dictators who are partial in helping us with the greater war, which is to eliminate this cancerous, virulent growth of Islamofascism? I mean, really, that is what we face. And being pragmatic, I would have to say, and after our experience in Iraq and the difficulties there and taking a look at that culture, I don't think this particular religion is ready for democracy. I mean, I think until they have their own enlightenment, like Christianity had, I do not see them as being capable of having a democratic society. I mean, just take a look at the way they treat their women. And it is always it astounds me that Western liberals particularly aren't jumping up and down. But of course, they're caught in a conundrum. On the one hand, they say that there is no culture that is superior to the other, right? Yet, on the other hand, they talk about it, certainly in our society, of women being objectified, being sexual objects, right? Having to defer to men in the society, that it's a society dominated by men. And they go on and on about it, and been going on about it for, what, four decades now? Yet silent when it comes to the plight of these Muslim women that are denied the ability to drive, are considered very clearly to be chattels, can be raped in their society and end up getting lashes for having been in a position to be raped by a man. You would think that these hardcore feminists in our Western society, these liberals, would be up in arms about this and going on and on and on about it, but they don't. And why don't they do that? Because would that mean that we would be saying, hey, our culture is superior to your culture? So a couple of things I want to throw out there. One is, I mean, maybe we just have got to ditch this idea of spreading freedom and democracy and sit down and try to support the strong man in that part of the world that can really help us in the overarching aim of ours, which is to eliminate these Islamofascists. Now, the other thing is this whole idea, which I still kind of confuses me, is why our feminists and our liberals in our society aren't up in arms about this kind of treatment of women in that part of the world. It astounds me. I mean, you know, you have stories of women helping their husbands murder their child as an honor killing. And on and on. I mean, we hear it again and again, and yet there isn't this convulsion. This convulsion. Coming from our liberal element in our society that says, hey, this is wrong. This society, this particular way of life is wrong. These women are being are downtrodden, aren't being liberated at all. Yet we say nothing. I don't understand that. And when people do say something, they're mostly roundly criticized in our own society. I'm thinking of this Dutch politician. Geert Wilders. He says the Quran, he compares the Quran to Mein Kampf. He's been named the Netherlands Politician of the Year in a poll run by the public broadcasters there. His latest project is a short film about the Quran that will be released next month. It has stirred anger even before much is known about it. Mr. Wilders, who has had round-the-clock protection for 3 years due to the death threats against him, says the film will illustrate how the Quran inspires people to do the worst things. He has called for the Quran to be banned. With this film, I'm trying to show not only in words, but also images exactly what I mean. Mindful of the backlash provoked by the publication in the Danish newspapers in 2005 of the cartoons, remember that, depicting Muhammad? Government ministers have expressed concern, but said there's not much that they can do. Some public figures outside Parliament have called for a movement against Mr. Wilders. Mr. Wilders' proposed solutions are deeply radical. He's talking about stopping all Muslim immigration to Holland, banning the building of mosques, and asking the 1 million Muslims among the Dutch population of 16 million to go to their own countries or give up their religion. He remains a highly controversial outsider. Many Dutch Muslims and non-Muslims alike would rather not discuss him, but his Party for Freedom won 9 of 150 seats in Parliament in the last election, and it regularly polls above that level. All right. Well, I mean, what do you do if you have people that you bring into your country? Here's a country of 16 million, of which 1 million apparently are not assimilating in any way, shape, or form. And you have this population within your country that vows to change your population fundamentally. What is the answer to that? All right, 1-800-449-8255, 1-800-449-TALK, T-A-L-K. I want to bring up or talk about a couple of things. One is this whole idea of promoting democracy and pushing that in that part of the world. Is it worth it when you've got 48% of the people in Pakistan alone, I mean, supporting and approving of Al-Qaeda, approving of Osama bin Laden, and approving of the Taliban? I mean, this is what, the eighth nuclear power in the world? And you could end up electing somebody like Osama bin Laden and giving him nukes in his hands? Or someone of his ilk? I've got lines open and available, 1-800-449-8255. Wiseback, in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
back in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. Thank you for joining us. It is 23 minutes past the hour, and once again, I'd like you to make a note of going to michaelsavage.com and helping Michael's fight against CARE and help protect free speech. If you go there, you know that he launched a lawsuit against CARE. He's alleging it to be a terrorist front in our country. And he's launched a lawsuit to protect free speech. And, of course, lawsuits cost money. So when you get to a site, michaelsavage.com, look for that CARE lawsuit, and there will be a link there that says donate, and you can do it. It's pretty simple, with a credit card, any major credit card, or with PayPal at michaelsavage.com. I'd encourage you to go do that now. Don't put it off, because free speech needs to be protected at all costs. All right, we're talking about what happened in Pakistan yesterday with the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. And, I mean, a number of things. One is, should we really be pushing for democracy in that part of the world? Terry, in Chicago, welcome to the Savage Nation. Hello, Terry. Hello, Terry. Okay, I guess you're not there. Wayne, you're next. Wayne in Houston, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thanks. I want to make a quick point when comparing the Reformation in Christianity to an anticipated similar enlightenment occurring in Islam. When the Reformation occurred, it was really going back to the roots of Christianity, and really that has occurred already within Islam, and that's what Wahhabism is. I mean, that was the whole movement, was to go back to the source of the Quran, and so that's really where this is all sprung about. So I'm not saying that Islam can't be modernized, but your point you made earlier is there's not much penchant for it in the Islamic world for this modernization movement.
Well, not that I've noticed, but I don't know whether you can say that the Wahhabi sect is on a par to what happened to the Christian religion in terms of the Reformation. But it could also very well be, you know, in Christianity we have what we call our fundamentalist Christians. They're a small sect of overall Christianity in our own country. I don't see that, though, as being the Reformation. All right, sir, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the Bible had been translated a bit, you know, around the 1500s or so, or earlier than that, into a common language, and then with the printing press, so it made it more available to average readers, which was kind of spurring the Reformation. Whereas with Islam, I mean, I'm not saying only with Wahhabism, but that really was the movement of to go back to the source in a similar way. So, in other words, you can't really compare what was taught by Christ versus what was taught by Muhammad. When you compare the two, they're really not apples.
Well, I'm not doing that, and you're getting off on a tangent. Let's bring you back to the point here. What about trying to encourage democracies in that part of the world?
Well, I think that based on what I'm saying and what you're saying in terms of the polling there, it's not a good idea. I mean, you know, it's probably supporting a strong man, is I don't know if you suggested that, but might be a better avenue at this point, until you can build maybe some structures to support people who are free-thinking. That's the problem.
So when we talk about democracies, of course, we tend to think of our model. We tend to think of the Canadian model or the British model, the European models that exist. But do we think in terms of intertwining religion and politics? Because in those societies there, and in the Muslim religion itself, they do not extricate one from the other. As a matter of fact, they encourage their politicians to be religious leaders.
Right.
So, I mean, are we ever going to get what we really think we want to get? Because I don't see any fundamental change. If somebody said to me today that, yes, you have a democracy there now, and, you know, you've got Al-Qaeda as one of the parties, and then you've got Ahmadinejad's party as another party, and they're vying for power all the time, they're both fundamentalists. Both of them are not going to really give us what we want. They continue to want to export their religion around the world by sheer force, if necessary.
Correct. You're not going to develop the institutions, the underlying institutions that support democracy, you know, due process of law, that those kinds of things really aren't there in the societies. So I think that makes your point about that.
Yeah. It was just a waste of time. Jared, KSTE, Sacramento, welcome to the Savage Nation. You've got 30 seconds.
Yeah, hi, Peter. My point was that Japan, I think, was in a real similar situation, you know, turn of the century. They were, you know, a brutal society, you know, willing to sacrifice their own people all the time. And we beat democracy into them. We pounded it into them. And I think you bring up some very valid points.
Yeah, but the dynamics are totally different. I mean, first of all, you know, you went in there and you put basically a czar in place, and then by the name of MacArthur, who ran the whole country, single-handedly wrote the Constitution for the country. We occupied the country. We're not in a position to occupy these people because they are in cells all throughout Europe, if you're to believe what you read. They have cells in Europe. Some people say they have cells here in this country, and they certainly have places in the Middle East where they hang out. And in some areas have a significant proportion of the population there. Certainly the backing of them as well. So this is a totally different situation, which you cannot win you by a traditional conventional war where you kind of just enforce your own beliefs on a population. Wise back in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Wise back in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. It is 34 minutes past the hour. Thank you so much for joining us. And we're discussing the events in Pakistan and what it means in terms of, and even our experiences in Iraq, what it means in terms of our propensity now under the Bush Doctrine to spread freedom. And maybe we can no longer spread that freedom through diplomacy. It has to be spread through a sword. But is that really something in our best interest? In the overarching view, look at this war against Islamofascism, is it in our interest to do that, or do we have to support strong dictators? I mean, hold our nose and support strong dictators who are, well, I mean, I don't know why is that so repugnant? I'm just thinking out loud here. Why would that be so repugnant? I mean, we do all kinds of business with the butchers of Beijing. I mean, that's a communist, a country that is, in effect, a dictatorship granted of a small number of individuals, but still a dictatorship. We do all kinds of business with them over there. So what's the difference between supporting, say, a strong man, if Musharraf were really a strong man, versus somebody that would be aligned more closely with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or Osama bin Laden? What is the difference? I mean, shouldn't the only concern that we have really now be what is in the best interests of our country and our safety? Because, I mean, from what I've seen and what I've learned about this culture, where the underpinnings are the Muslim religion, the Islamic religion in the Middle East, I mean, forget it. I mean, I don't see any vestiges of democracy there at all. And they, I mean, to me, it's just so foreign. I mean, look at the story out of Malaysia, which is right next door to Singapore. It is supposed to be one of the more moderate Muslim nations in the world. Well, it's been reported now that Christians are being banned in that country from using the word Allah. The Malaysian Deputy Internal Security Minister said, "We cannot let other religions use it because it will confuse people." He said only Muslims can use the word Allah. And of course, if you were to use it, you could end up in jail in that country. So, I mean, how can one sit back here and say, hey, I can empathize with that, or I can understand that? I can't understand that. I can't understand the guy in Mississauga, Ontario, that killed his 16-year-old daughter because she wouldn't wear the headscarf in traditional Muslim garb. He killed her. I can't understand. In any part of my, there isn't a cell in my body that has any understanding for a mother who assists her husband in killing a daughter as an honor killing. I just can't. And therefore, I have no problem in saying that my culture is superior to that culture. And you can call it cultural imperialism, call it whatever the hell you want. But hey, those are the facts. And anybody that thinks any differently is deluding themselves. Or they are so weak and have such a high need to be liked by others, they simply can't stand by any of their own principles for fear of somebody disapproving of them. And then there are real weaklings. I want nothing to do with them anyway. Next up, Christine in York, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I just wanted to touch on the fact that what you were talking about on Wednesday night about immigrants coming to our country and adapting to our culture.
Yeah.
I fully believe that they should adapt to our country or to our culture and our beliefs. I mean, they can keep their own beliefs also, but they need to adapt to our culture and our language. They need to learn our language, because if we, as Americans, if we were to decide to go and live, you know, in another country, it's not like they're going to say, oh, it's okay that you don't know our language. We'll, you know, we'll do everything we can for you because you don't know
our language. Well, if you go to Saudi Arabia, you better put away that Bible or you're in big trouble. William in Raleigh, North Carolina, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thanks, Peter. Glad to be here. The subject I wanted to touch on is that the people who have been behind these suicide attacks, including the 9/11 attacks, are Muslim fundamentalists. And they've made their intentions pretty clear. They're bent on destroying infidels. And the reason behind this is because they believe that God has instructed them to do so based upon their interpretation of the Quran, the fundamentalist interpretation. And there have been numerous polls that show tremendous support in favor of jihad and suicide bombings in that part of the world. And I think it's a natural extension, because if a person believes sincerely in God, they will seek after that belief with great fervor. And the logical end of this is fundamentalism, because they're going to want to follow God's rules as strictly as possible.
That's and your point.
What's that?
Your point.
My point is, when we engage Muslim fundamentalists and we approach them from the point of view as being a Christian nation, a predominantly Christian nation, we engage in a dialogue where all we're doing is arguing over how many fairies can dance on the head of a pin. They believe that they have the right interpretation of what God wants. The majority of the people in our country believe that the Christian interpretation is what God wants. And as long as we engage in this...
Yeah, but there's a difference. I mean, look, we're not going out there and at a point of a gun, you know, blowing up innocent people on behalf of our Christian beliefs.
Oh, you're absolutely right. That's true. But what we are doing is we're acting as enablers, because all they do is they look at us and go, you're Christians, you've got the message all wrong.
So how are we enabling them?
How are we enabling them? Because we encourage them by our acceptance of ancient mythology as being true and valid in the modern world, as accepting theirs as true and valid, and it comes down to a point where all we're doing is fighting over who's...
Oh, we're not fighting over that at all from our side at all. These people have launched a cultural religious war by their own definition. It's got nothing to do with us. Goodbye. Mark, WOR, New York, New York, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yeah, hi, Steve. I got three
Hey, Mark, it's Peter.
Oh, Peter, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I got three points to make about democracy that we tend to forget. First, the Founding Fathers made this constantly clear, that democracy demands a level of civility and decency from its people, from its
mm-hmm.
participants,
That's true.
From its citizens.
True, true.
That's first. Second, not too many people know this, but part of the reason there was so much trouble in Europe in the last century was that democracy was believed to be anachronistic. Mussolini himself was quoted as saying democracy was a 19th century form of government.
As did Hitler. Hitler believed the same.
Hitler, too. That's second. And third is going to sound like a play on words, but it's something, it's food for thought. You know, we send our armies out to different parts of the world, and we say we're trying to make the world safe for democracy. But we're really saying, or we're really believing, that democracy is going to make the world safe. So we may be putting...
But it is it not? I mean, I can't remember a free and democratic country that launched a war aggressively, that was the aggressor in a war.
Okay.
Can you?
No, I don't.
So, and then therefore, people draw the conclusion that, you know, by and large, democracies don't tend to go to war. They go only to war to defend themselves. So that's the thinking there. But, I mean, the more I look at that part of the world, I just don't see that possible. I just don't see these people at this point in time being able to deal with democracy, because quite frankly, their interpretation of their religion intertwines the religion with politics and therefore and government. And therefore, I don't see how this is possible now. You know, Osama bin Laden, his letter to America, I mean, he trivializes the fact that we are a nation of laws, that we're a republic, that we have a constitution. And he trivializes it because he says, after all, look, you've got Allah's law, the Sharia. And that is the supreme law. Drop your constitution. You don't need that. That's merely man-made. Sharia is the ultimate law. So how you could never reconcile that with us. And if Osama bin Laden and his ilk believe that they are charged by God, Allah, to spread their faith and to do it by force if necessary, nothing will stop them short of extermination. Chuck, Chicago, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, it's all right to support a dictatorship, but we're going to be criticized for it. Good case in point would be when we sided with Saddam Hussein against Iran, what was the better of two evils? We got criticized by the liberals right off the bat in this last election, and we're back in dictators. You can't win. A good example of a religious government is Iran. When Jimmy Carter was president, he handed Ayatollah complete control because he didn't back the Shah. He stopped, shipping stuff. So we used to deal, with all kinds of equipment. They built hospitals over there for the people. Granted, it's not a perfect solution, but things were under control. I mean, what do you want, control?
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting. If Pakistan implodes totally, excuse me, you've got the eighth largest nuclear power in the world, in the hands of radical Islamofascists? I mean, is that really what the liberals of this country want? And do they honestly believe that they could sit down with someone like Zawahiri or with Osama bin Laden and sit down and start a dialogue while they've got their fingers poised on a button to nuke?
I don't know. Maybe I'll sit right next to him, liberals, because they all seem to be too patriotic. You know, you get offended when you say they're not patriotic. There are patriotic liberals, don't get me wrong. But there's a faction like the Michael Moores and the Sean Penns and all this. I don't consider them patriotic. Well, they're Jimmy Carter when they're going over to the enemy. They must have working for the CIA.
All right, thanks. Bye. Al, WOR New York, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, Peter. Hey, great hosting job. Yeah, my thing is, definitely, we are wasting time. We have two choices in America. One is to continue with this democracy in the Middle East, or we can bombard them with bombs. All right? It's either bombard them with democracy or bombard them with bombs. So we have our choice right there. And
Do you think bombarding them with democracy is going to work?
No, I don't think so, because they just don't have it in their minds. They don't have it in their religion. That hasn't gone through a reformation to do so. So, but the only thing is, what's going to hold us back, I believe a majority of the Americans aren't willing to take that step and push for any future president to enable such an act.
Well, no, the only way that would happen is if we were attacked again and it was somewhat more vicious than the 9/11 attack. I mean, I could see that if there is a nuke somewhere over one of our major cities that directly maybe kills 10 or 20,000 and maybe has a fallout deaths of another 40 or 50,000, that might very well bring about that type of anger and that type of momentum from the population to go after the country that hosted the launch of that particular or supplied that particular nuke. But, I mean, I don't see it at this point that we would be anywhere near doing that, do you?
No, unfortunately not. See, that's the case.
At one point, I think we have to understand, I mean, all the PC aside, this is, by the very definition of our adversary, a religious war. That's not by our choosing, not by our definition, but it is very clearly by their definition. And I don't understand how we can stand back and can you say, no, it's not, you can't call it a religious war. Stop it. I mean, look, the aggressor has the perfect right to frame what they're trying to achieve. And they've said unequivocally what they want to achieve. They expect us to embrace Islam. So therefore, it is a religious war. They are trying to force their will on us through the use of force. And for us to sit back and say,
This is not a religious war. Think about, that's insanity. It's just an absolutely insane position. It is now 12 minutes before the top of the hour. It is Peter Weisbach in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. Savage. Back sitting in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. It is my honor and privilege to be here. And once again, a reminder that, you know, Michael Savage is defending free speech. He's launched a lawsuit against CARE. He alleges that to be a terrorist front. And he needs help to proceed with that lawsuit. If you go to his website, michaelsavage.com, you'll see the CARE lawsuit. And then there'll be a link there that says donate. And I think he said, he had, what, some 7,000 people so far that have given some money to help this cause. So I encourage you to help him. It's a very courageous thing that he's doing, and I back it 100%. And, of course, I myself have personally thrown in a few shekels on this, and I would encourage you to do so as well. Whatever you can afford would be certainly very much appreciated. And we discussed the situation about is democracy something worthwhile to try to bring to that part of the world, the Middle East. Let's go to Tom, listening to us on KXP. WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi. I wanted, real briefly, three Muslim pro-Western leaders murded. You had President Zia-ul-Haq of Pakistan, who was helping us versus the Soviets in Afghanistan. The Soviets warned him, and then they threatened him. 3 weeks later, he's dead. You had Anwar Sadat, who threw out the Soviets, who were virtually taken over Egypt. And then Sadat, mysteriously, was murdered. Now you have Bhutto, who was allegedly pro-West, and she's murdered, and she had just been threatened by Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two al-Qaeda leader. And Zawahiri was exposed by Litvinenko. Remember the man in England who was murdered by, they say, Putin with the polonium, the Russian-Soviet defector?
Right.
One of the major things Litvinenko did, the reason he got killed, was he exposed the fact that Ayman Zawahiri was trained by and controlled by the Soviet intelligence. So sometimes when you see things like this, there are other things behind it. I've been talking
about you're not suggesting that there's this resurrection of the Soviet Empire.
Well, I have the Soviet publications, and they're quoting Che Guevara saying, when believers join the revolution, we'll be invincible. Now, he was, of course, talking about the penetration and control of the Christian churches in Latin America and elsewhere. So what I've alleged for 25 years is that the Soviets are working. They tried to change Muslims' minds, and then they realized instead of trying to convert them out of Islam, exploit the Islam that they already have and just push them to do things that are going to help the Soviets long range. And,
Jimmy, thank you. I got to move along. Thank you for your call. Medina or Medina. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Happy New Year to you, Peter, and all the members of the great Savage Nation.
All right.
I'd like to say that I am astounded that these loudmouth feminist liberals haven't said a word about the death of Ms. Bhutto. And, of course, we know that the Islamic culture does not allow women or tries to stifle their achieving power and education and so on. So it's normal. Now we know why Condi Rice, who was a very capable and brilliant woman, has not been as effective as she could have been because simply the Islamo-fascists, who are the enemy around the world against civilization, they will not take into account a woman to dialogue or have any kind of negotiation with. And this is the very reason I believe Hillary Clinton should not be president. She would be totally ineffective, and worse, she's on the side of the Islamo-fascists if you take into account.
Now, why do you say she's on the side of the Islamo-fascists?
Simply because they're always enabling them in every way they can. They gave the PLO thousands of machine guns. They gave Arafat an open invitation into the White House when we know that Arafat is the godfather of modern terrorism, as Michael Savage himself has brilliantly written in his wonderful books, which should be read by everyone in the audience. And not only that, she has empowered, Bill and Hillary Clinton have empowered every one of our enemies around the world, especially the Chinese communists. She's totally in the...
Well, look, I mean, that's not just... I mean, to be fair, it's not just the Clintons or the Democrats. It's also the Republicans. Thank you very much. I mean, this whole idea, the way we've empowered them is to basically allow our corporations to offshore their manufacturing over to China, thereby giving them a huge trade surplus in American dollars, and that gives power. That's what makes them powerful. We are rebuilding, single-handedly arming that nation, where you have the Pentagon, on the other hand, kind of making plans that maybe one day we'll be at war with that country. I mean, go figure that. Wise back in for Michael Savage on The Savage Nation.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Thank you very much for joining us. It is Peter Weisbach sitting in for Michael Savage, who continues on his vacation. This, of course, is the Savage Nation. And as always, it is my honor and privilege to be here. I'm going to throw out the results of a poll here. There's a poll, a recent poll, or study, I should say, that said that 59% of Americans believe that government makes it harder to get ahead in life instead of helping people. 29% didn't believe that. Let me restate. I want to state that again. 57% of Americans believe that government makes it harder to get ahead in life instead of helping people. And I'm wondering where you come down on that. And if you call me, I'd like you to have kind of an idea of how you think it either helps you, if you're in that 29%, or if it hinders you, if you're in that 57%. I'd like some kind of concrete, so at least your opinions, on where you think it helps or hinders. Now, this story, I think, was pretty self-serving. It was published in the Sacramento Bee, written by John H. Bunzel. He said, once their candidate for president has been chosen, the Democrats will confront two opposing forms of reality that will play a role in their success or failure next November. One evokes their hope of capturing the White House and maintaining control of Congress. The other is a sober warning of a deep-rooted problem they will encounter that could thwart their far-ranging plans. Should they win, they will face the often overlooked reality that people's faith in government, the very instrument progressive Democrats want to use to improve people's lives, has been severely undermined during the years of the Bush presidency. Consider the damage already done. Apart from the war in Iraq, Republican Senator John McCain has pointed to other failures of his own party, the mismanaged response after Hurricane Katrina, the Washington corruption scandals, unchecked government spending that have led Americans to have no trust or confidence in government. Democratic consultant Stanley B. Greenberg believes Republicans have so discredited government that the Democrats may have trouble getting landmark legislation through Congress. There is a perverse consequence brought about by the scale of conservatives' failure, Greenberg said. Not only have they communicated their own incompetence, but also the message that government in general is incompetent. Well, of course. I mean, I had to chuckle when I read that, how self-serving this is. Because I can remember years and years of Democratic Congresses and Democratic presidents. Johnson was one of them. Carter was another one of them. What do we have? The banking scandal. Do you remember the Democratic House Speaker Wright, who had to resign because of the book that he wrote, which was bought by, I think, unions, by the thousands? Ross Jankowski used to be the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, very powerful, I think, using government employees for his own benefit at his own home. And he ended up spending some time in the slammer for that. This makes me sick when people play politics like that. Now, did the Republicans, once George W. Bush got to power and they had 6 years of a majority Republican Congress, did they do proud? No. They blew it big time. But so have the Democrats in the past. It just seems to be that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But here's this question. So ultimately, and call me cynical, I was reading a piece by Lee Hamilton, the retired congressman, Democrat from Indiana, who's been around, he was, I guess, in the House of Representatives for some 34 years. And he wrote a piece, Why Politics is So Partisan. And he talks about the difference, he says, in the 60s when he entered politics. He says the prevailing attitude toward the federal government was that it had its place in life, but one that was fairly limited. Keep the government off my back was the sentiment that he heard most frequently. He said, these days, people want help. A subsidy here, a tax break there, a program or a grant targeted to their needs, and they come streaming into Washington to state their case. So which is it? I mean, what is the real America here, do you think? I mean, do you think that when 57% of Americans believe that government makes it harder to get ahead in life instead of helping people, is that because the Republicans screwed things up so badly? Or is it because that's the ideal and it harkens back to our distrust as a people of government? Back to our founding, as a matter of fact, the revolution, the distrust of government. And that is no longer the reality. That's the way we still believe. But however, the reality is quite different. When it comes to my own special interest, I want to get government help. Well, here's my number. 1-800-449-8255. 1-800-449-TALK, T-A-L-K. And I've got a line open and available. I mean, is this a statement that you resonate with? Government makes it harder to get ahead in life instead of helping people. If you are part of the 57%, give me a call. I want to hear from you what you think specifically makes it harder for you to get along, that government is doing that makes it harder for you to get along in life. Now, if you're part of the 29% that say, I don't believe that at all. But how does government make your life easier and better? 1-800-449-8255. Listening to us on WOR in New York, we have Lillian. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Good evening. I resonate with that very well, sir. What happened for me, it was between the age group means a lot. I'm a senior now, but between, say, 40 and 65, working very hard, not a great big pay, raised two children, and there was nothing available. We're talking about maybe 20, 25 years ago. So now, when Medicare kicks in, of course, it was impossible. You know, you can't get insurance because of your age, medical insurance. And yet now, I have to say, it helps a lot in certain areas. Yes.
So you're in the 29%, and you like it because of the social programs for a senior citizen.
Right.
The Medicare, the Social Security,
right.
That kind of stuff.
Right.
All right. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Nate, listening to us on KGA in Spokane, Washington. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I have a particular... I'm part of the 57% that thinks that government is a hindrance. And my problem with it is I run a business, and one of the things that we fight really hard for is to afford new equipment. And so we're currently trying to buy this new equipment... And it's something that we can't do right now, yet the government is making us pay a B&O tax on equipment that we had already paid sales tax on. So it just doesn't make sense to me that we have to continue to pay an operating tax on...
Okay, hold on a second. Okay, you're talking about the business and occupation tax, which exists in the state of Washington, where you've got to pay your tax out of the first dollar that comes in.
Right.
You pay whether your business is profitable or whether it's losing money, doesn't matter. In the state of Washington, you got to pay the first dollars to the state of income.
Absolutely. So we fight like crazy. We have to pay that tax on things when it doesn't even make sense. So we buy a big saw and it costs us $100,000. We pay tax on that piece of equipment, and we have to continue to pay tax on that equipment all the time. Yes.
Well, for the revenue that you bring in, is that what you're saying?
Right.
Okay. Sir, thank you for your call. Appreciate it. All right, so it's a hindrance to you. Todd, KDWN in Las Vegas. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Welcome. Thanks. I think the government definitely helps people. I'm one of the 29%, I guess. And I don't think that too many Americans realize what kind of influence the government has on their dollar. Everybody's so wrapped up in capitalism and that word that I don't think anybody really knows what it's all about. But if our dollar is too strong, then people overseas aren't going to buy our stuff. And if it's too weak, then it's going to be tough to buy their stuff.
So how is it helping you?
How's it helping me? It's creating wealth. You know, I go to the bank and I get a loan and then I buy something and I make something out of it. And if I can't do that, then...
No, hold on a second. So you make what out of it? Give me a concrete that we're dealing with.
I'm saying the bank, okay? The bank gets money.
You go to the bank and get money to do what with?
To start a business, to buy a house, to do anything.
Have you done that? What have you done with a loan?
I've graduated with my accounting degree, and I just bought a house.
Okay. But how does the government come in on that? Why is the government necessary for you in order for you to borrow money?
When I was 18, I couldn't afford to pay the $43,000 it cost to go to college, and I took a subsidized Stafford loan from Fannie Mae, and I wouldn't have been able to do that without our government. I don't know if you can do that in Pakistan or Iraq. I don't think you can.
Well, any good socialist country, you can do it. I mean, go to Canada, you get your education for a fraction of what we pay for universities down here. But then again, you know, you have the government, occupying about 60, 65% of the GDP. I mean, flows through the government up there. Sir, thank you very much. Tony, KXL, Portland, Oregon, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, how you doing tonight?
Good.
Saying about the, I heard you talking about government 57% instead of helping people they're not. And I was just, I'm having a plumbing business, and in order for me to run a plumbing business here in Oregon, I have to have seven different licenses to operate my business, which in Washington you only have to have two. So
oh, wow.
The government, instead of helping people, eliminate like fees and licenses. Every year they add one more in fees and.
Now you think that these? Are you saying that you don't think that plumbers should be licensed by the state at all?
No, you should be licensed, but you're not supposed to have seven different licenses to operate.
So you think that this is just a ripoff to get money?
Well, I think Oregon government is trying to, they're not very business friendly. And instead of helping businesses and people, they're actually pushing down on people and businesses.
All right, sir, thanks. One of the things, too, to watch for in government, of course, is that you have organizations actually lobbying for certain restrictions within their own industry. And they do that for the purposes of putting up artificial barriers to prevent other people from entering into that particular industry in order to lessen the competition that they face. And so, you see, that's the problem when you allow government to become so ubiquitous as we have, that everybody is either out there trying to defend themselves against the actions of government to prevent something that's going to be injurious to them or their group, or they're out there trying to get some of the spoils of getting elected and get special treatment from the government. That's what it's about. It is a far cry from what our Constitution calls for. It is 19 minutes past the hour. It is Peter Weisbach in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. Savage. Back in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. We are discussing this study that showed that 57% of Americans believe that government makes it harder to get ahead in life instead of helping people, and 29% disagree with that. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Diane is next. Listen to us on KNEW in San Francisco. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello, this is actually Daniel. My opinion is that government actually fosters dependency, which is my first point. My second point.
Why and how do they do that?
Well, I mean, if you're needing help, there's the potential of relying on the help, and there's no drive. You get that check in the mail every week, and you just become lackadaisical and just don't want to try hard enough to get ahead. So instead, you just get by with what you get from the government.
Well, of course, the other is it not in the interests of a politician, who most politicians, and I know I'm stereotyping here, but most politicians, within weeks or at least months of being elected for the first time, are concerned about getting reelected because they kind of like that position of, prestigious. You get a lot of attention from people from all political walks of life who are trying to influence you. And so you then become interested in becoming reelected. And how better to do that than to tell people you're basically giving them something for nothing by what you're actually doing, of course, is robbing Peter to give something to Paul or vice versa. But that's really what it's about. It's kind of legalized extortion, isn't it?
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
All right. Sir, thank you for your call. Appreciate it. George in New York, listening to us on WOR. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi. Peter, I'm really shocked that 100% of Americans don't know that the government has institutionalized job discrimination based on race, and it's euphemistically called affirmative action. And in addition to discrimination on hiring based on skin color, the government promotes discrimination on job promotions. They promote discrimination on admission to colleges. And what's most shocking of all of this is in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. I don't know how this has gone on for so many decades.
Well, it's gone on, but with the complicity of a corrupt Supreme Court.
But where are the people? The people are like a bunch of sheep. They let this thing go on and don't even object to it. It's been accepted by the American sheeple, as Michael calls them. I mean,
yes.
It's disgraceful.
Is this a revelation you're giving us?
I'm not. The question here is, does the government stand in the way of people?
How does it harm you?
It has harmed me. I'm retired now, but when I was employed, it harmed me because I was denied promotions based on my skin color.
Well, that's harm. You know, the late Harry Brown used to say that the government breaks your legs and then hands you some crutches. And I think that's a beautiful analogy. I am for a very limited government because I am a strict constitutionalist. And that's exactly what was envisioned for this country when it was formed, was to have a loose federation where there are very clearly defined powers with the federal government. This is Wiseback, in for Michael Savage, on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Peter Wiseback in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. By the way, Happy New Year. It's my honor and privilege to be here, of course. The number is 1-800-449-8255. You can join me at 1-800-449-TALK, T-A-L-K. Study says that 57% of Americans believe that government makes it harder to get ahead in life instead of helping people. 29% disagree. What side are you on, the 57% or the 29%? And I want some concretes, okay? Give me some concretes. Nothing but the facts, ma'am. Don, you're up next. Welcome. Don is in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm part of the 57%. I've been a salary employee all my life, and it's impossible for a person to accumulate any savings that way. I'm opposed to the social architecture, the redistribution of wealth, and I read something on the Internet today where over the last 5 years we've sent about $10 billion to Pakistan. And what has it gotten us, and where is that in the Constitution? We got absolutely nothing from that. government is too burdensome, and I think within 5 or 10 years we'll see this government collapse.
In what way?
I think it's going to collapse just because it's spending too much, and the people won't be able to pay the taxes. It's just going to go down the drain.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. John, KPRC, Houston, Texas. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thanks for taking the call. I respectfully disagree with the person that just called. Government's not going to go under. Government's self-serving. They're not going to go under because they only hurt themselves. Just the standard of living is going to go down. And I appreciate you taking my call. Great show. A lot of callers have been touching on the point. You know, to the gentleman that's a plumber that needs 7 licenses, you know, it's overdoing it. It's not an effort to make sure he's a legitimate plumber. It's an effort to pick his pocket. As far as what I mean by government self-serving, there's a lot of items out there that the government's doing that's not necessarily in the best interest of the United States, or at least on the surface it doesn't appear to be in the best interest. One thing that we got going on, which of course is a hot button, especially in this election, is the war on terror. Now, currently we have approximately 50,000 troops in Germany. Why do we have 50,000 troops in Germany? Why don't we relieve the troops that are in fighting the war on Iraq, or the war on terror, sorry. Or why don't we go ahead, if we're serious about securing the border, take the troops out of Germany and send them back home? You know, why are we sustaining troops in foreign countries? Is it to help support their economy because they're going to be spending some of their money there? Or is it to keep up the budget that we have to spend on military items?
Well, it's a combination of that. Also, of course, if you have a worldwide interest, as we do, then you need to have bases around the world in which to stage.
Troops in Germany, and I'm just picking on one country. You know, we've got this going on all over the world. But that's just as far as military is concerned. As far as healthcare is concerned, a friend of mine that I work with, he just had his child come in for his 6-month shot, or I'm sorry, his 9-month shots. Well, they also tested him for allergies because he's got the sniffles. They tested him for allergies. He came back negative. The doctor prescribed him a non-allergenic medicine to help with his runny nose. He's going, well, what is this? Well, this is something we're going to give him. He doesn't have allergies, but it's going to help him with his runny nose. He's like, well, I'm not going to give my child a narcotic to help him with his runny nose. You know, it's a runny nose.
All right. Well, I think we're getting off the track here. Thank you. Moving on to Joe, listening to us in San Francisco on KNEW. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, sir. I wanted to say that I'm in the auto body repair business, and I wanted to say I'm all for people getting trained, getting licenses, and getting permits before they can operate on people's vehicles and or even houses. I mean, why wouldn't we license people? Why wouldn't we require people to pay for their licenses? They're earning money. They're earning good money in this area, and they have to be licensed.
Yeah, but why would it not be up to the individual consumer to decide whether or not the people that they're dealing with are competent?
Well, if they come to my house or I take my car to an auto body that it's not licensed, it's not permitted, and they show me phony paperwork, how would I know if they're qualified to work on my car or not without an organization?
Well, there might be organizations around. I mean, there are organizations now that you can go to find out how good any particular product is. I'm sure that there are organizations on the web. Is it Emily's? There's one of these organizations that is out there where people exchange their experience with different contractors. I mean, there are ways around that. I don't think you need government, and certainly not to the degree of 7 licenses. Come on.
I don't need you need a government. I don't think you need a government, but you do need a body of organization that is not easy to bribe. It's not easy to overpower. I think it's a very good thing. You look at some shops in this area. Even with all the rules and regulations we have, they're operating without a permit, without anything, and no one even knows about it.
You're contradicting yourself. On the one hand, you say that it's good that we have this government control and government licenses, government-issued licenses. On the other hand, you say there's body shops operating outside of that control.
So that means there is not enough governing body.
No, so that means that the government just simply is ripping off people for license money. Isn't that right?
Well, in a way, I guess they're not working in their capacity.
All right, thanks for your call. I want to share, there are very few politicians that remain true to the original intent of why they sought office in the first place. And it's the rare politician that doesn't get co-opted by the system, because there's this kind of a natural propensity to end up giving in to a consensus within your own caucus. But the chap that I know that was in state politics here in Washington, that is really a man that had stayed with his particular value system and didn't budge, much to the chagrin of other caucus members in his political party. But he was telling me of one incident where he had received some money from the PAC, I think it was from the Restaurant Association. And when he was in the state capitol in the legislature, there was a move afoot to put up some kind of training or new license. I forget the absolute details of it. But he just merely saw this as more government, intrusive government, and he was against it. And the spokespeople from this restaurant association came to see him and indicated to him that they really supported this, that it was training or something, but it was clearly just another way to put up another barrier of entrance into the restaurant industry to keep new competitors out. And that's how my friend saw this particular piece of pending legislation. And the restaurant spokespeople who came to see him in his office in Olympia reminded him that they had supported his candidacy, his election campaign, and that they had made financial contributions to his campaign. So he asked them how much they had donated to his campaign. And they told him the amount, I forget what it was. And so my friend pulled out his checkbook and wrote them a check and said, thank you very much. Now, there are very few people, and I've known a number of politicians in my lifetime, that really stay so true to the course as my friend Mike did. Very few. So it does happen. But the propensity is for people to be co-opted by the system. And what happens? You start to rationalize. Well, if I don't make this compromise, then we're going to lose X number of percent of people voting, and then we won't get reelected. Then the other person's going to get elected. And, oh, they're really so bad. I better we compromise on this. And so what we have now is this basically people so preoccupied with getting to be reelected again and again and again, that this is no longer a debate between two opposing political philosophies, trying to persuade each other to the validity of their particular perspective, or indeed to persuade a significant percent of the majority of the electorate to their way of thinking, to buy into their philosophy, to their solutions, to vote for them. This is no longer it. Have you noticed that? It is just, it's nothing but carping. It's nothing but nitpicking. It's nothing but attacking. It's nothing but tearing down. You know, other than the kind of feel good, you know, we're going to be open, a more accountable government. How many times have I heard that in the past 30, 40 years? How many times? I mean, if I had a nickel, I would be a multimillionaire. And you know it's all nonsense. It's all that fresh air stuff. It's not going to happen. And it's not going to happen until we demand change. You start defeating some of them, it can happen. And we have to get back to a more limited form of government, the way we intended to be. George in Chicago, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you for taking my call. I don't think it's the government that makes our life harder. I think it's the greediness of people. They never have enough. They make billions, and they still want more. One example, George Bush gave them tax cuts, yet everything went up except the income.
I don't understand. Why would somebody be greedy? What do you mean?
I don't know. So
why do you think these people? You're talking about the old thing is why did the richest X percent get most of the tax breaks? It's because they pay for most of the taxes. Half the people in this country don't pay any income taxes anymore.
I was happy they got a tax break. The more rich people, the better for the country. But look, everything goes up from the car insurance, to water, to cigarettes, everything goes up except the income. Now, I don't work for the government.
So why do you think that is so?
Because they are greedy. They want 10%.
No. Yeah, why? So who's giving them? Look, it's not government. The reason that this is happening, that your costs are going up and your income is not going up, is because our jobs are being outsourced. So the available labor pool has been so expanded now because it now includes overseas countries such as China primarily, but through the North American Free Trade Act, you also have Mexico, which is much cheaper in terms of labor, and you have this influx of millions of immigrants from third world countries, low skilled, also keeping down wages. So like any other commodity in economics, when there's an oversupply, what happens? It becomes cheaper. So how can you blame, I mean, why are you greedy? Why would you blame greedy people for that?
Because they are the ones who keep wanting to increase the profit, increase this, increase that. Till when? You can't live in Chicago. I'm in Chicago. I have to move out. You can't survive. They're absolutely insane. Everything goes up, 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 except your income or inflation. So what happened with my income? Inflation doesn't affect it. So I'm saying people are greedy and they're insane. They did it in Florida when the insurance rates went so up. People are leaving Florida. It never happened before.
Well, of course it has to go up in Florida because they are in the path of hurricanes. You know, this kind of a politics of envy is interesting because I spent a number of years in Canada, as most of you know, and that country is driven and has been driven for decades by a deep rift between socialism and, liberalism at best, with liberals up there are considered to be conservative. But it is all about the politics of envy. It's what so-and-so has, and this person is greedy, and that person is greedy. And I don't understand how greed is responsible for any of this stuff. Look in the mirror. You know, who has allowed these people to strike free trade agreement after free trade agreement and has allowed American corporations to offshore the manufacturing for this country? Who runs up the deficits year after year? Hey, it's done through the government. And who puts the people in power? Well, look in the mirror. You're the people voting for these folks. Shem in Salt Lake City, Utah. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I'm with the 57% on that one. I feel like the government intrudes too much on everything we have. I'm a small business owner here, and it's just hard to meet all the regulations and taxes and that. And, you know, you just want to work and make a living, and it's just a hard time with all the regulations.
So when you say all the taxes and all the regulations, what type of business are you in? And tell me a bit about the regulations.
Well, I'm a cabinet installer, but, you know, I've got a couple employees, and when it comes to that, you have to pay unemployment and workers' comp, and you know, the list goes on and on. And right off the front, you know, the government takes, I would say, probably 15% of what my gross income out of that. And, you know, I'm not expecting a handout from the government for my health insurance and that. I'm willing to pay all that. But it just seems like they just so many regulations and that it's hard for a man to just work on his business and do what he does best. He has to become a businessman to even cooperate with it all.
Well, I know some people that, you know, have downsized to the point, smaller businesses downsized to the point that it's only themselves doing the work or maybe another family member, but that hiring people is just too expensive and too convoluted, too many regulations. 1-800-449-8255 is the number to call. 1-800-449-TALK, T-A-L-K. Does government help or hinder? Wise back in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
It is Peter Weisbach sitting in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. Once again, a reminder to go and help Michael Savage defend free speech in his lawsuit against CARE. If you go to michaelsavage.com, you'll see the CARE lawsuit, and there will be a link there that says donate. And I encourage you to do that. It's very simple. It accepts all major credit cards or PayPal. And to do as I have done and thousands of other, I think some 7,000 people so far, have helped Michael Savage defend free speech with this lawsuit against CARE. Help him. It's at michaelsavage.com. We're discussing whether government helps or hinders your life. Brian, KSMA in Santa Maria, California. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
It hinders me. I'm 23 years old. I have a great job. Can't get ahead of anything. Taking $700 out of my paycheck for what? What do they need my money for? I can't buy a house. No one's going to loan me money. There's not a single government program I can apply out there that will help me anyway. And I'd like to comment real quick on another one of your callers. You know, the way they're stealing money is from Mr. and Mrs. Johnson down the street complaining to the congressman, I need this, I need that, I need more, more, more. Go get me more. Go get, take money away from the rich people and bring me more because I don't have enough. You got enough. You have a job, you have a house, you have some kids. Take care of them. You don't need anything from the government. You can't get yourself with a little bit of hard work.
All right, sir. Thank you for your call. Ryan in Maine, welcome to the Savage Nation.
I have to say, as an Army veteran of 10 years, that at this particular point in time, government is certainly hindering our ability to progress within a normal timeline. Unfortunately, a lot of funds that should be allocated to programs that Democrats as well as Republicans vote on is misallocated into spaces that citizens don't get.
Well, give me a specific, will you, please?
Okay, as a specific here in my hometown, for instance, we have an influx of Somali refugees.
Mm-hmm.
And our city takes local state government welfare and provides them free housing, gives them a $10,000 tax-free loan on a home if they choose to purchase it.
No.
Yes, sir. In my current college, when I came back from combat, I was forced to pay for my own education. Government did not provide me my GI Bill, but yet my current tax dollars are paying for a Somali to sit next to me and have an interpreter.
Isn't that outrageous?
Well, what it tells me is that the people that we elect obviously have a preconceived idea of what it is that they want to happen with their election status. They don't really represent us the way I thought they were going to. And especially as a veteran, I just feel like government's put the handcuffs on our feet, and we can't run. All we can do is hobble from side to side.
All right, so thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Isn't that an outrage when you think about it? These people who get themselves elected, who start to use other people's money instead of their own, to fund their own personal favorite charities, wherever they want to spend the money, on something they would never consider spending their own money, but they so easily can spend other people's money. All right, Carl, very quickly, you're up next to listening to us in Los Angeles on 8:30 a.m. You've got 30 seconds. Go.
I think it's imperative that we have government involvement, especially in the case of safety and corporations adhering to safety requirements. Because if back in the day you had people falling, killing themselves, and job instances.
Right.
And
now it's offshored over to China. We allow them to do it. Do the cheating.
Who do the cheating?
The government can't even keep the stuff out of the country that's coming in from China. I mean, toys that have lead paint, pet food that's poisoned, toothpaste, and on it goes. I mean, government is not going to protect you. You'd have to live in a totally, totally autocratic state with. Got to have like half the people at least being an agent of the government. All right, it has been my honor and privilege to fill in for Michael Savage. Happy New Year. This is Peter Weisbach on the Savage Nation.
Savage.